That lines tensions on the rise in northern Syria. Turkey is preparing to carry out new attacks on border areas hours after its airstrikes killed three Syrian soldiers in Aleppo. The Palestinian Foreign Ministry says Israel's reaction to the Holocaust remarks by President Mahmoud Abbas is aimed at diverting attention from its crimes. And also ahead, Britain's inflation rate hitting a record high in four decades as soaring food and energy prices deepen the cost of living crisis. Hello and welcome everybody here in the Iranian capital, Tehran. This is World News. Our top story for this half hour, Turkey's military is warning citizens in northern Syria to stay in their homes as Ankara gets prepared to stage an attack. Local Syrian sources say the strike alert comes as Turkish drones and troops have been deployed to border cities in Aleppo Governorate. Turkey has ramped up its attacks on Syrian border cities recently. Three Syrian military personnel were killed and six others injured in Tuesday's airstrikes on the outskirts of Aleppo. Syrian military sources say the strikes are part of Turkey's long-running efforts in support of terrorist groups in the country's north. Damascus has responded by targeting Turkish bases and armed groups inside Syria. It has vowed not to let any attack on its army positions go unanswered. Mohammed Ali is joining us now from the Syrian capital, Damascus. Mohammed, please bring us up to speed on this recent warning from Turkey. And also, what kind of a response are we expecting to see and hear from Damascus in this regard?
Yes, first of all, we have to start by speaking about what happened yesterday. It was definitely a significant escalation of the situation on the borderline between Syria and Turkey, in which the Turkish side yesterday attacked several positions for the Syrian army, particularly in and around Kobani, Ain al-Arab, a border town between Syria and Turkey over there on the Syrian side, of course, in addition to Turkish shelling of various positions for the so-called SDF, Syria's Democratic Forces. What happened was that Turkish fighter jets attacked Syrian army positions directly yesterday, killing, according to an official Syrian military source, killing three Syrian army soldiers and injuring six others who were taken to a hospital inside the Ain al-Arab Kobani town itself. An official military source here in Syria said that this was confirmed and that this comes in the framework of the ongoing Turkish support to terrorist groups. And then the military source confirmed that the Syrian army responded back directly to the source of gunfire, meaning the positions of what it described as the Turkish forces of occupation in that area, destroying some of those positions and inflicting human casualties and damages on those Turkish points. And also the Syrian army responded back by attacking the Turkish-backed armed terrorist groups on Syrian soil over there. What is very significant to point out to in that military statement, Syrian army military statement, was that the Syrian army will respond back directly to any gunfire on all front lines. This is definitely a significant development happening there in the north, perhaps the first time we see such kind of direct clashes or targeting between Syria and Turkey over there. Also, during the night, just yesterday, some mosques in Turkish villages on the Turkish side of the border announced warnings using the speakers of those mosques to the families to stay indoor as there will be a military ground operation by Turkey into Syria. This amid reconnaissance drones flying over the borderline, and also amid reports that the Turkish army deployed a large number of troops on that borderline. However, following that announcement inside mosques over there, the governor of Gaziantep, Gul over there, said on Twitter on his account that the announcements exceeded its purpose and that the situation is normal and there's nothing outside routine, which also indicated then that it seems that there will be no military operation. It's just just kind of attacks by the Turkish air force and also artillery. But definitely, this is an escalation from the Turkish side, and definitely this is an attack and an aggression which undermines Syria's sovereignty.
All right, thanks a lot. Muhammad Ali joining us from the Syrian capital, Damascus. Elsewhere, the United States says it's studying Iran's response to the European Union's proposals for the revival of the 2015 nuclear agreement.
We have, in fact, received Iran's comments on the EU's proposed final text. We have received them through the EU. We're in the process of studying them. We are, at the same time, engaged in consultations with the EU and our European allies on the way ahead.
Iran has already submitted its own assessment of the proposals to the EU. Tehran is now awaiting the bloc's response, which acts as the coordinator in the talks for the revival of the nuclear agreement. Iran's foreign minister has earlier said that he sees no obstacle to the deal if Tehran's red lines are respected. According to Hossein Amir Abdullahian, Tehran expects Washington to step forward with a realistic approach and more flexibility if it's serious about finalizing the deal. Still, he says Iran will put its plan B into action in case the talks end inconclusively.
They talk about plan B. We also have our own plan B, but we believe that in the end, this matter should be resolved with the realistic approach of all parties through negotiations.
The European Union has proposed what it calls the final draft for the revival of the 2015 agreement. The U.S. sent the deal into limbo after withdrawing from it in 2018 and bringing back sanctions on Iran. Talks have been held among the remaining signatories in Vienna since April last year to salvage the accord. Abbas Aslani is a research fellow at the Center for Middle East Strategic Studies in Tehran. He explains Iran's stance in the talks aimed at reviving the 2015 deal.
Well, the Iranian current administration has been saying that its foreign policy does not rely only on the JCPOA. An Iranian president in his first press conference said that Iranian foreign policy under his administration will not start from the JCPOA and it will not be limited to the nuclear deal. It means that Iran also sees other alternatives and options in order to improve its foreign relations with other countries. And we have been seeing that in the past, let's say, months or in the past year, in the tenure of the current Iranian president, Iran has been trying to engage in economic cooperation with neighboring countries or regional countries and to somehow find opportunities for more trade, let's say, engagements with other countries. In case that there is no agreement, Tehran, what is arguing is that it will try to continue to find new opportunities independent of the nuclear deal. However, it will not ignore this chance of the negotiations in order to lift the sanctions. You know, there is the argument that the nuclear deal or reviving the deal is not the, let's say, the panacea to the problems in the country. But what is needed is the, trying to find those potentials in order to increase the level of, let's say, trade volume with other countries.
Recent remarks by Palestinian President Mahmoud Abbas accusing Israel of committing a Holocaust against Palestinian people have prompted a flurry of reactions from different sides. During a recent visit to Germany, Abbas talked about Israel committing 50 massacres in Palestinian villages and cities and drew a parallel with the Holocaust. Those comments triggered a reaction from German Chancellor Olaf Scholz, who called them outrageous. He said the remarks diminished the importance of the Holocaust. Shortly after that, Israeli Prime Minister Yair Lapid called what the Palestinian president said about Israel a monstrous lie. The latest in reactions has come from the Palestinian side as well. The Palestinian Foreign Ministry now accuses Israel of seeking to divert attention from its crimes. It says the regime does not even stand comments which remind it of its criminal acts. The Palestinian Islamic Jihad movement has vowed to continue resistance against Israel until the liberation of the entire Palestine. The group's representative to Iran made the pledge during a presser in Tehran on the achievements during Israel's recent deadly onslaught On the Gaza Strip, Nasser Abu Sharif also referred to the death of senior members in Israeli strikes, saying those killings won't stop the movement's activities. He noted that the Islamic Jihad is well organized and that new figures would replace those martyred. Speaking at the venue, the Palestinian Hamas resistance movement's representative to Iran vowed to avenge the blood of martyrs. Khalid al-Ghadoumi also dismissed claims that the resistance groups are disunited. He said Hamas and Islamic Jihad have been working in coordination since 2014. Israel launched a three-day offensive on Gaza on August the 5th, killing dozens of Palestinians. In response, the Islamic Jihad fired hundreds of rockets, some of them deep inside Israel. Moving on to the latest developments from the war in Ukraine. Russian forces say they've attacked multiple Ukrainian military targets using high-precision weapons. Ukrainian officials say two civilians have been killed and seven wounded in Russian shelling in the past 24 hours. Kiev says its armed forces have repelled Russian attacks in several directions, including Slavyansk. On the southeastern front, Moscow says Ukraine is trying to provoke Russian counterattacks by shelling the city of Enerhodar, where the Zaporizhia nuclear plant is located. Meantime, the UN Secretary General Guterres is scheduled to meet Ukrainian President Volodymyr Zelensky in the western city of Lviv to discuss the conflict, especially the situation surrounding the nuclear plant, which is currently in Russian control. Eighteen months on, the disputes related to Brexit are far from over, with the UK now complaining that the European Union is blocking its access to scientific programs. The British government says it has launched legal proceedings over its exclusion from the EU's scientific research programs. According to Foreign Secretary Liz Truss, the EU is repeatedly seeking to politicize scientific cooperation and breach of the agreements in place. Also, her department has written to the European Commission asking for dispute negotiations under a post-Brexit trade deal. Britain negotiated access to a range of science and innovation programs, but last month the EU terminated grants of 115 British scientists because of a dispute over a trade with Northern Ireland. Well, Britons are feeling the pinch of the deepening cost of living crisis as inflation hits a new record high for the first time in more than four decades. The UK has registered a double-digit inflation rate, according to the Office for National Statistics. The Consumer Price Index rose to 10.1% in July from 9.4% the previous month. That's even higher than what the economists are expecting. Food prices are skyrocketing, and officials say that's the main contributor to the rising inflation. The Bank of England has already increased the interest rate six times to bring the situation under control. It's now predicting an inflation of above 13% for October and a long recession at the end of the year. Well, we've talked to Professor of Economics Rodney Shakespeare about rising inflation in Britain. He believes Western countries are suffering the consequences of their failed policy of the war in Ukraine.
A few months ago, the government said, and welcomed, it said 2% inflation, which would be transitory, which means it would soon pass away. It is now on the Bank of England's statement, 13%. But if you look at the way the inflation hits on the items, for ordinary people, particularly the poorer people, the inflation is in practice around about 20%. So you then have to say, well, what is the difference between then and now? And the answer is the war in Ukraine. And you will say, well, is the war in Ukraine going to come to an end? And the answer is no, not if the UK government can help it. You see, Western foreign policy is involved in another debacle. And whereas Iraq is over, but all the consequences go on. Libya is over, but the consequences go on. This genocide in Yemen is over. Well, it's not over. The consequences go on.
Moving on to the latest development from the Korean Peninsula with reports of North Korea firing two cruise missiles towards the sea. South Korean Defense Ministry says the two missiles were launched off the country's west coast. So far, no confirmation from Pyongyang. North Korea has been working on its nuclear program despite UN sanctions in recent years. Pyongyang argues that it needs nuclear weapons for self-defense purposes. It's opposed to an irreversible denuclearization, viewing it as a breach of its sovereignty. Just hours before the launch, South Korea's president called for talks with the neighboring North. He said any future dialogue should eventually bring the two sides closer to peace rather than being just a political show. We were joined by our correspondent in Seoul, Frank Smith. A short while ago, he gave us his insight on the future of the inter-Korean relations. Let's take a listen.
Well, I think for there to be a breakthrough in terms of inter-Korean relations, there needs to be progress between the U.S. and North Korea. It's the U.S.-backed United Nations Security Council sanctions that you refer to. That's really going to be an ongoing sort of intractable stumbling block in terms of getting North Korea toward negotiations over its nuclear programs or some type of arms control mechanism in place. Certainly under a conservative president here in South Korea, it's unlikely to see the kind of initiatives that we saw from previous President Moon Jae-in that organized the engagement and the summits that took place between the North and South and even between the U.S. and North Korea. So it's likely we're going to see kind of a tension on the Korean Peninsula as kind of the status quo for at least the foreseeable future in the Yoon Suk-yeol administration here.
Last week, a raging wildfire in Portugal's nature park was declared under control, but the blaze is now burning out of control once again. More than 1,000 firefighters and a dozen aircraft have been deployed to fight the flames. The smell of burning from the Serra da Estrela nature park fire in central Portugal has even reached as far as Madrid. Spain is also dealing with its own wildfires. So far this year, the country has suffered more than 300 wildfires fueled by scorching temperatures and drought conditions. Firefighters are now battling a huge blaze in southeastern Spain that has burned through nearly 10,000 hectares in an area that is hard to access. And that brings us to an end here on this edition of World News. Do stay tuned, though. Bye.
Fruitful Moments with IRIB English Radio. Log on to our website, www.parstoday.com/en.
Bismillahir Rahmanir Rahim.
Assalamu alaikum wa rahmatullah.
Selection of Ayatollah Khamenei's viewpoints.
Hame ba wujood ghudde saratani Israel mukhalifin.
All of us are opposed to the cancer's tumor, Israel.
Wajh mushtarak hame wahdat ummat islami.
Unity of Islamic Ummah is the aspect that all of Islamic denominations have in common.
This is part of the speech delivered on January 23, 2022 by Imam Khamenei, the leader of the Islamic Revolution, in a meeting with the eulogists of the household of the Prophet sallallahu alaihi wa alihi on the occasion of the anniversary of the birth of Lady Fatima al-Zahra salamullah alaiha. Gabriel would inform Fatima al-Zahra about the Prophet's position with God the Merciful and his high status. He would tell her about the events that were to unfold for her children in the future. He would tell her about the things that would happen to Imam Hassan and the events of Karbala, the events that would happen to the other Imams, peace be upon them, and about the life of the Imam of the time, Ajjalallahu ta'ala farajul sharif. And the commander of the faithful would write these down. This is a very important matter. According to the Holy Quran, Gabriel descended upon someone other than the Prophet only once in history. Then we sent to her our spirit, and he appeared to her a well-made man. The Holy Quran, Surah 19, verse 17.
دنیای اسلام یک نسخه امروز دارد و اون اتحاد.
The world of Islam has one single prescription today, and that is unity. This prescription exists in all Islamic countries. Nations should be united.
If the Arabic word ruh, soul, refers to Gabriel, there is some disagreement about this. In the story of Mary, the exalted God has only sent Gabriel to someone other than a prophet just once. Of course, other angels have frequently descended upon people, but Gabriel only one time. But in the case of Lady Zahra, the discussion isn't about him descending one or two times on her. Gabriel would visit her frequently and show his respect to Lady Zahra, peace be upon her. The Holy Quran speaks about Lady Fatima in the chapter, The Man, Al-Insan, in the verse of purification, Tathir, and in the verse of Mubahila. These are verses that almost explicitly speak about Lady Zahra, peace be upon her. There are also verses that indirectly refer to that great personality as well. This is a very important point that the exalted God speaks about Fatima al-Zahra's actions and those of her family in the chapter Al-Insan. This is a flag that the Holy Quran raises up and places on the door of the house of Fatima al-Zahra salamullah alayha. We only feed you for Allah's sake. We desire from you neither reward nor thanks. The Holy Quran, Surah 76, verse 9. These personalities work for God, are sincere, show purity and offer selfless services. To whom? To orphans, to the needy and to captives.
Allah, I want to thank you. I want to thank you for all the things that you've done for me through all.
Wildfires in Greece, Turkey, the United States.
Palestinian prisoners in Israeli jails continue to engage in hunger strikes.
Kim Yo-jong, the powerful sister of North Korean leader.
On the news line.
The attack, which occurred just outside one of the gates of the occupied old city of Al-Quds on early Sunday, left at least 9 Israeli settlers injured, 2 of whom are in serious condition. Reports indicate that at least one person ambushed a bus as it arrived at the western wall in the old city. Witnesses say that as people were boarding the bus, they heard gunshots, screams, and warnings that this was an attack. The bus driver has told Israeli media that he tried to pull away, but was unable to do so. Since then, Israeli troops have been raiding homes in a Palestinian neighborhood, and reports have emerged that several suspects were involved and that some were even arrested. Palestinian resistance groups have described the attack as a natural response to the occupying Israeli regime's daily crimes against the Palestinians, calling it a heroic act. The world, however, has remained silent when atrocities against Palestinians occur, which is on a daily basis. The Palestinian Center for Human Rights reports daily killings, detainments, and other Palestinian violations, which is described as a slow death and genocide against Palestinians. But those killings don't even get reported. This attack took place in the occupied Al-Quds, where Israeli troops have been stationed in large numbers. But doesn't the fact that it took place there mean that Israel is failing to prevent these attacks from occurring?
Well, the first thing to understand in the conflicts that we see developing is that the Israelis, of course, are the responsible party for a lot of the antagonism and the aggression and the attacks that are constantly erupting in Al-Quds, in the Palestinian territories, because they are constantly waging a program of genocide and attempting to remove all ethnic natural inhabitants of the lands and replace them with Israeli settlers. So what the Palestinians and other people do in these areas that are being subjected to forced extermination and relocation is the same thing that any free people would do. If anyone, including myself, was forced to leave my home or evicted or lost loved ones and experienced such a horrific a program of expulsion that the Israelis daily practice, of course people would be responding with any kind of militant response that they possibly could.
Last week, Israel carried out its latest round of aggression against the Palestinian people under the pretext that it was thwarting a terror attack by the Palestinian Islamic Jihad. Despite the Israeli atrocity, Palestinians did strike a ceasefire deal with the regime. But the truce is widely believed to be fragile in some sense, as the Palestinians did stop their retaliatory attacks, but Israel has yet to heed their demands. All this, along with the long list of previous Israeli attacks and atrocities against Palestinians, has led to an atmosphere of tension and frustration in the occupied Al-Quds. While the US and Europe condemn the attack, they are encouraging Ukrainians to resist the Russian war, even calling for armed resistance against Russian forces. This shows the double standard approach they have towards Palestinians. But the latest Israeli attack is only one in a long list of the regime's atrocities against the Palestinians on a daily basis. From the destruction of their homes to false imprisonment and the murder of innocent people, including women and children. All this has led to widespread anger among Palestinians whose rights have been violated, leading them to take action themselves. But the question remains, will attacks similar to the bus incident increase since the Israeli violations against Palestinians will continue?
Well, the only way that the crimes against the Palestinians that the Israelis are perpetuating will end, will stop, is when the Israeli government, the Israeli people, rise up and tell their government, we cannot survive the counterattacks any longer. We cannot endure the pain and the suffering that is being inflicted upon us. So we are demanding that the government be overthrown, replaced with new leadership that will honestly and authentically seek out peaceful negotiations of peaceful coexistence that take into account a lot of the crimes and violations of treaties that have occurred in the past, but that are dedicated to moving forward in a positive, mutually agreeable way. So the Israelis and the Israeli people really are the ones that have to suffer and before they recognize that their own government, their own military are perpetuating the suffering of the Israeli people, because the Palestinians are never going to relent. They're never going to stop fighting for their lives, fighting for their children, and fighting for their homes.
How many wars is the United States fighting right now? Well, the answer is zero, as under the Constitution, Congress must declare war, and the last countries that Congress declared war on were Bulgaria, Romania, and Hungary in 1942. 8 decades and what seems to be zero wars. Any countries with such a record must be one of the most peaceful places on Earth. But as history has shown, this is not the case with the US, as it is fighting and has waged wars on many countries across the world. It just doesn't want to call them wars. Over the last 20 years, the US has dropped an average of 46 bombs and missiles on other countries each day. And now, a new study has revealed that more than a quarter of the 400 wars which the US has sugarcoated in terms such as a military-led operation, police actions, or humanitarian interventions have taken place in West Asia and Africa. So it seems that as Americans struggle to address urgent needs at home, their governments have committed them to endless wars in an attempt to support what seems to be one of the key pillars of the US, the military-industrial complex. The
US has tried to be on the first hand with an image of also being seen as a global policeman, which came and, of course, as some have argued, it's done more harm than good. When you look into the global dominance and production of all these weapons and also use of it in terms of interventions, you see a situation whereby US wants to be the first, to be seen the most powerful nation in the world, to be seen as the one that can intervene and maybe make a difference, whichever difference whose interest it serves. Of course, they will have to define that. It's a bit a gray area. You cannot define it very clearly.
The world seems to have entered a new era after the Second World War, one where relations between countries has been at a much more stable and peaceful state. But while the decline of war and the relative harmony among great powers is cause for celebration, the US seems to believe otherwise in light of its grand strategy and political powers that seem to be running its system, namely the military-industrial complex. The US has constantly, since the Cold War, intervened in foreign affairs and engulfed itself in wars far from its borders, wars which in most cases seemed endless and even pointless at times. But while the US military is swamped in conflicts in other countries, it's hard to see any end in sight, especially an end where it is the victor. A month into his presidency, Donald Trump said that the US no longer wins wars as it once did. And the reason behind this might be the fact that the US isn't necessarily in wars. It is in fact in foreign interventions where its presence has more often than not worsened the situation, further aggravating an already chaotic crisis. And all this may only be to support the thriving war business in the US. Big war CEOs say the chaos in the world has led to excellent prospects for them, while arms contractors say recent violence and tensions in the Ukraine conflict works in their shareholders' favor. And this leads to the questions that do war manufacturers and US foreign policy go hand in hand in promoting wars?
You think about the terrorism happening within the Sahel region, and of course, US is an interventioning power also. They have to do what they have to do, use of drones and all these things. So they are giving us another reason as well. But elsewhere, whether it's in East Africa, Somali intervention, this is also given a different recent campaign, war against terror. So there's always a reason being given. So therefore, war never looks like it's been manufactured or it's been planned, deliberately planned or calculated to maybe maximize sales of weapons. But truth be told, that whenever there's a conflict, weapons will always be used.
The U.S. Justice Department says FBI agents have found 11 sets of classified documents, with some marked as top secret, in Trump's Mar-a-Lago home in Florida while executing a search warrant this week. The warrant was publicly released following a federal judge's order. It states investigators had probable cause to believe Trump violated three federal crimes, including violating the Espionage Act, obstruction of justice, and criminal handling of the government records. Media reports say the FBI search of Trump's Mar-a-Lago home was for possible classified material. materials related to U.S. nuclear weapons. Trump, however, rejected that. He called it a hoax and claimed he had no stored classified information. The unprecedented raid on the residence of the former U.S. president provoked a backlash from leading Republicans who described the move as politically motivated. The Florida governor, Ron DeSantis, said the search of Trump's property was another escalation in the weaponization of federal agencies against the regime's political opponents. Also, Florida Senator Marco Rubio stated that Biden is using his power to persecute Trump. But the White House has denied the allegations, saying it was unaware of the search before it happened. Moreover, there have been growing threats in recent days against FBI agents and offices across the country. On Thursday, a man who tried to breach the FBI Cincinnati office was shot and killed by police after he fled the scene. Law enforcement officials say the man may have been present at the January 6th riot. Right after news of the FBI search of Mar-a-Lago broke, there was a big spike in tweets referencing civil war. Analysts and reporters say this is alarmingly similar to the activities in the lead-up to the January 6th attack on the Capitol.
Well, I think it's true that there are people in the permanent national security wing of the U.S. government who don't want Trump to return to office. And whether or not those people are currently raiding Trump in Mar-a-Lago in order to try to get proof of crimes they could use to charge him and put him in a position where he legally can't run for office.
Shockwaves spread across America in response to the news that the FBI had searched the private Florida residence of Donald Trump. It prompted threats of retaliation from the former U.S. president and his allies. The surge in violent rhetoric drew concerns that it could lead to civil unrest and a social crisis. Department of Homeland Security officials have been warning for months that this type of warlike rhetoric, which came to fruition on January 6th and which continues to be fueled by reactions to ongoing investigations of Trump, is increasing the risk of more widespread political violence ahead of the midterm elections in November. This comes as recent polls have shown a rising acceptance of political violence among Americans. About 1 in 3 Americans say they believe violence against the government can at times be justified. According to another study by researchers at the University of California Davis Violence Prevention Research Program and the California Violence Research Center released last month, more than half of Americans expect that a civil war will erupt in the U.S. sometime in the next few years.
I think it is a sign that the U.S. Polarization has gotten way out of hand and could be leading to a constitutional crisis and possible civil war or social breakdown kind of situation. We have seen this polarization growing for many years.
Meanwhile, as much as 40% of election and poll workers in the largest jurisdictions in the U.S. have so far said they won't be returning to their jobs out of their own fears. Other states are seeing drop-offs too. Nearly 1 in 3 local election workers said they felt unsafe because of their jobs. The alarming partisan divide within the U.S. political system ahead of the vital midterm elections in November had raised concerns over the possibility of internal conflict.
Tensions are still high between China and Taiwan. The flare-up comes days after the provocative visit by U.S. House Speaker Nancy Pelosi to the island. Officials in Chinese Taipei have rejected the one-country, two-systems plan proposed by China for the self-ruled island. Taipei says that only the Taiwanese can decide the island's future. The reaction came after China published a white paper on Taiwan, which Beijing says shows the resolute determination of Beijing to peacefully resolve the unification issue. The paper lays out China's position on the self-ruled island. It says Beijing would never allow any attempt to separate Taiwan, but also would make every effort to achieve unification through peaceful means. Taiwan has accused Beijing of using House Speaker Nancy Pelosi's visit as, quote, an excuse to destroy the status quo. Pelosi visited the island on August 2nd despite vehement protests from China.
What they want to do with Taiwan is fight, U.S. wants to fight China to the last Taiwanese. If not to the last Japanese, if not enough, then to the last Korean. Ultimately, the U.S. will not fight the wars. It will finance them. It will give weapons. It will antagonize us. It will antagonize both sides. And that's what they want to do. And it's actually a replica to the World War II.
Beijing reacted with an unprecedented burst of military around the island. The drills lasted for several days. Taiwan has also launched live fire drills in the wake of China's largest ever military exercises. The white paper issued by China this week was the third document of its kind over Taiwan. The previous editions were the Taiwan Question and Reunification of China, which was published in 1993, and the One China Principle and the Taiwan Question, which came out in 2000. China insists differences in the social systems in mainland and Taiwan are, quote, neither an obstacle to reunification nor a justification for secessionism. But Beijing says it will not rule out the military option to achieve such reunification.
What China wants to do with this white paper is just to find a way with Taiwan to get it back to its sense, because reunification will happen. The problem is that if it doesn't happen peacefully, it will happen by force. China doesn't want to do it by force, but it's being pushed on the corner by the U.S. because the U.S. is actually slowly declaring Taiwan independent.
Speaker Pelosi's controversial visit has undermined the One China policy, which is recognized by nearly all countries of the international community, including the United States. Under the policy, the international community recognizes Taiwan as part of China, and the U.S. is committed to recognizing and having formal ties with China rather than the island of Taiwan. But Washington, contrary to its stated policy, continues to undermine China's sovereignty and courts the secessionist government in Taipei.
So what is the one country, two system? It was applied actually the first time is in Hong Kong. And so since the handover in 1997, they applied the one country, two system. The way it was done in Hong Kong was that Hong Kong could keep its a very high degree of autonomy. And actually they did it for Hong Kong. And it was a way, a showcase that they could show to Taiwan to say, well, in case you were to reunify with the mainland, this would be the system.
China has proposed the one country, two systems model to win Taiwan back. The policy allowed the Chinese government to successfully solve the question of Hong Kong through diplomatic negotiations with the British government. Hong Kong was under colonial British rule since the 19th century. China resumed to exercise its sovereignty over the island on July 1, 1997.
But what happened in Hong Kong was that you had the external forces. You had a massive amount of money being poured by NED, National Endowment for Democracy, and you had the usual suspect, the whole team of regime change working for the US, the MI6, and they did everything to destroy the one country, two system in Hong Kong, and that ended up with the riots. And then in 2020, you had the national security law.
Under the model, offshore regions like Hong Kong remain under China's sovereignty but can retain their own economic and administrative systems. Now China insists the same model could be applied to Taiwan.
This is IRIB English Radio.
Thank you.
please log on to our website, www.parstoday.com/en.
ارزش ها و صفاتی که انسان احترام میگذاره همه این ارزش ها در علی ابن ابی طالب جمعه.
Human in general, whether a Muslim, non-Muslim, or even a disbeliever, respect the values present in the character of Ali ibn Abi Talib.
لا يقيم امر الله سبحانه الا من لا يصانع ولا يضارع ولا يتبع المطامع.
Imam Ali alayhi salatu wasalam, the reason we love him as our hero, or not only in the material sense, in the spiritual sense, in the leadership sense.
The universal persona of Imam Ali alayhi salam in To My Brother.
Imam Ali alayhi salam, the most distinguished and extraordinary personality in Islam after the Holy Prophet Muhammad. His entire life is a struggle for the advancement of Islam, the universal religion prescribed by Allah for all of humanity. Imam Ali alayhi salam was the living miracle raised up by the Holy Prophet Muhammad himself, and was not only the successor and the executor of the Holy Prophet Muhammad, but as history testifies, he was also a great human being. A brave defender of Islam, a just and fair judge, a generous philanthropist, a champion of the people, and the most pious person of his time. And in today's world, overcome by evil and darkness, and oppression and slavery, and tyranny and falsehood, a quick look into this beacon of truth and justice, a look into the universal persona of Imam Ali, is greatly useful for making and changing our lives, our families, our societies, and our world into the beautiful world that Allah has planned for humanity.
قال أمير المؤمنين علي عليه السلام قرنت الهيبة بالخيبة والحياء بالحرمان والفرصة تمر مر السحاب فانتهزوا فرص الخير.
Imam Ali, peace be upon him, said, "The consequence of fear is disappointment, and of bashfulness is frustration. Opportunity passes away like the cloud. Therefore, make use of good opportunities."
Welcome back, dear friends. It's great to have you with us. This is IRIB English Radio, the program's To My Brother, and we're discussing the universal persona of Imam Ali alayhi salam. Dear friends, Imam Ali alayhi salam and his universal persona teaches us a great many things. One of the things that Imam Ali alayhi salam's universal persona teaches us is types of people in this world. One type of people is knowledgeable and is a scholar and is wise, and the other, unfortunate, picks up the path of ignorance. An individual who picks up the path of ignorance, Imam Ali alayhi salam describes that individual as an individual and a person who goes out early in the morning to collect things whose deficiency is better than plenty. And this individual who has picked up the path of ignorance, they will collect these things until he has quenched his thirst from polluted water and acquired meaningless things. Now, this individual who has chosen the path of ignorance and chosen a path which is far from knowledge, this person, they go out in the morning, as Imam Ali says, to collect things whose deficiency is better than plenty. Now, why would they go after something which is not necessary? And matter of fact, as Imam Ali says, the less you have of this, the better it is for you. Because this individual has chosen the path of ignorance, this is why they go after things which are of no benefit to them. And they continue to go after these things which are of no benefit to them until they quench their thirst with polluted water and they begin to acquire things which are meaningless. Now, we really all have to reflect and think about ourselves and try to see what are those things which their deficiency is better than their plenty. Now, of course, this does not necessarily mean, you know, material wealth. Material wealth, if spent on the path of Allah and if spent responsibly, is an asset for every believer. But of course, there are certain things that are a deficiency. They should not be acquired, and one should be very careful in how we should spend our lives and make sure that we are not quenching our thirst and our desires with polluted water and acquiring meaningless things. Now, let's say the other side of the coin. What are things which have meaning? What are things which their plenty is better than their deficiency? Of course, taqwa, the God consciousness of Allah, working for the sake of Allah, having good morals and good manners, seeking a livelihood which is permissible and it is halal and it is permissible by the Almighty Allah. These are the things that we should be pursuing, the nearness to Allah, the closeness and the satisfaction of Allah. A beautiful lesson brought to us by the universal persona of Imam Ali alayhi salam.
Assalamu alaikum to you, dear listeners of IRIB English Radio, the program To My Brother. I'm Atta, the producer of this program, and at this moment, I invite you to listen to the Arabic text of Ziyara Aminullah along with the English translation. Please stay tuned.
بسم الله الرحمن الرحيم اللهم فاستجب دعائي واقبل ثنائي واجمع بيني وبين
O Allah, give favorable answer to my prayer.
acknowledge the praise I sign in worship. Let there be peace and harmony between me and my friends for the sake of Muhammad, Ali, Fatima, Al-Hassan, and Al-Hussein. Verily, thou art my benefactor who provides with bounties, the aim of my desires, the ultimate destination of my hopes in my future life and during this short life. Thou art my God, my Master, and my Lord. Welcome my friends, keep our enemies away from us. To save us from the evil mischief, divert their attention. Let the true world come out in the open, supreme and dominant. Refute and condemn the folly, rendered contemptible. Verily, thou art able to do all things.
And now we invite you to listen to Sayyid Muhammad Ridhvi.
Ali was even kind to the enemies. There are so many examples we have in his life. And inshallah tomorrow we'll discuss even more about it. But how was the attitude of Amir al-Mu'mineen in dealing with the enemies, let alone those who are friends? Look at the case of Ibn Muljim. And some of the young people have difficulty in understanding that Amir al-Mu'mineen knew Ibn Muljim and what is he and what are his intentions. There was a time when Ibn Muljim was there to collect the monthly distribution from Baytul Maal, and his name was also there in the list. And Amir al-Mu'mineen was standing there looking at the distribution of the Baytul Maal, the money being given out to the people, and he noticed Ibn Muljim in the line, and he says to one of his companions, "Uridu hayatuhu wa yuridu qatli." I desire his life, but he is looking forward to my murder. And so this fellow says that if that is the case, Amir al-Mu'minin, you know what are his intentions. You know, why don't you just arrest him? And this is where justice comes in. He says he has not yet committed the crime. Ali knew about it, not because of the normal channels of the spies and this and that. No, this was ilm al-ghayb. And we get this question sometimes that, if he knew, why didn't he stop? This is where we have to realize, and just to make it very brief, to have ilm al-ghayb is actually an extra burden on these awliya of Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala. They are given the knowledge of the unseen, the thoughts and the minds of the people, what they have in their minds and their thoughts, but they are not allowed to use it when it comes to themselves. They can only use the ilm given to them if they have to prove the truth of the madhab or the claim of imamat. They cannot use it for their own personal issues. And that makes their imtihan, their test and trial even more difficult. It's easy for us to go through a difficulty and challenging, not knowing what is in the next step, next day or next week. But if you know because of the supernatural means of knowledge that given to you, still you are going through the natural cause and effect in life, that becomes even more challenging and difficult. And Amir al-Mu'mineen, didn't do that.
Dear listeners,